Movie Mavericks.
The Movie Mavericks Podcast.
Movie Mavericks, speaking of fucking long, uncut European cocks.
The Movie Mavericks Podcast.
Now for your hosts, Jason and Trevor.
I can't wait.
Hey now, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of the Movie Mavericks Podcast. I'm Trevor Anderson. I'm going to send you over to our lovely Paris Rugard. He will tell us what we're doing.
That does sound nice. You gave me an idea for a future daughter that I'll never have, so thank you. Of course, we're talking about Troy, if you didn't get that great setup by Trevor. Hell of a segue there, my friend. And we're talking about Troy, the 2004 Brad Pitt, Wolfgang Peterson, blockbuster, summer blockbuster hit. This thing was a mega success at the time of its release, and to this day has retained a pretty good... I'd say word of mouth. It gets played an awful lot on cable. This thing's on TBS, TNT, Spike, one of the other things, every other weekend it feels like. So this has not faded away into memory. This is still pretty actively seen. And I don't know, did you like going back and seeing this? What were your thoughts? What did you think?
Yeah, I can't remember if I've seen the director's cut before, but that's what I watched. I think that's what you watched too.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, really liked this director's cut, and it really played out like a miniseries. And for someone to, you know, we've seen some of these miniseries like Hatfields and McCoys and things. I really didn't like those. They were kind of too drawn out. This was pretty perfect. You know, you could probably cut this up into 3 equal hour episodes and have something that works perfectly. You know, in every hour there's sex, there's violence, and there's the plot move forwards.
Yeah, this looks like almost like an HBO production nowadays. And that's how far HBO has come with their scale of doing things. At the time, this was a $175 million production in 2004, which equates to roughly, you know, around $300 million today. Mega budgeted. This did in equated money about $185 million here, but worldwide adjusted, you got to be looking at over half a billion, close to $700 million. So this made its money, was financially successful. More so than Alexander, which followed it later in the year, which was an outright flop. You can debate the two merits of the films, but taking on its own merit, Troy was very enjoyable for me. This movie came about strangely. The history of this was that Pitt was going to make The Fountain with Aronofsky for years.
Mm-hmm.
Was growing out his hair because of that man on a deserted island. I never saw The Fountain, first of all. Did you?
Yeah, it is. Not the greatest.
It looks esoteric. I just didn't want to see it. I just didn't appeal to me. But that film got canceled numerous times. Pitt moved on to this project. But Wolfgang Peterson, the director of this film, came off of the first aborted attempt at making Batman versus Superman. Do you recall that? Back in 2003, 2002?
Mm-hmm.
So this was Warner Brothers setting them up. And it's interesting because... if anybody is really out of place in this movie and has nothing to do, it's the Brad Pitt character. But they sold it on him. You know, it's the Brad Pitt vanity project. But wouldn't you agree that Achilles for long stretches at this movie does not much?
Well, I think there's a very good reason for that. And that's because of the way this movie's structured. And David Benioff, who, if you know, and I think a lot of people do know a little show called Game of Thrones. This guy is really, really good at writing... multi-character worlds, I guess, where you jump from character to character. And in some instances, it may seem like people aren't really doing much, like Achilles for, you know, a little bit of time here doesn't appear to be doing anything. But really, all the other characters are just carrying the story at that point, and it will fold back over to him at some point. You know, they all, throughout this entire movie, have scenes where they do nothing.
Did you see this in the theaters? How did you come about, Troy?
I saw this on home video.
I want to say, I saw this in the theater, but I want to say that you and I watched this in my apartment back in film school. Am I correct? You think this is how we saw this? On that little fucking 13-inch
absolute no memory.
TV I had that had like the built-in VCR. You remember that?
I mean,
fucking
we may have.
Thing?
We may very well have, yeah.
Which obviously does this movie no justice at all with the its sweeping vistas and landscapes, because this is a gorgeous movie in the... It's got, strangely to me, an uneasy mixture, though, of old-school filmmaking in, like I said, the Brad Pitt vanity project. Did you feel that at all? Like, there were certain parts of this that were clearly to appease a certain audience segment being nice?
Well, yeah. I mean, clearly everyone in this movie is made up, right, which is ridiculous. They're all beautiful-looking. with perfect makeup and always washed. So yeah, there is that. I mean, this director's cut does have more sex and violence in it.
A lot
than
more
the theatrical
violence.
Cut.
A lot
so,
more. A lot more violent than I recall this movie ever being.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, this definitely is, I suppose, made for a U.S. audience. I don't know. I mean, who do you think this is made for? I mean, the girls, the men.
They sold this movie.
It's kind of everybody.
On Pitt being a Greek god. Remember the bronze mm-hmm. posters with him mid sword right. swing with the flowing locks and whatnot. So this was during that sweet spot of his career, I'd say, with this and Mr. and Mrs. Smith, where, you know, smash hit after smash hit, and you know, had a huge audience, had done no wrong in the public eye up to that point. And to me, this was also a movie that, you know, Russell Crowe said something very interesting. I always remember when he was being interviewed by Ebert years before when Gladiator came out, and Ebert had given Gladiator 2 stars. Mm-hmm. And Crowe said to him, "You'll see when they do a couple more like this, how hard it is and how well we did." And it's true, because you can see that. Even though I like Troy and I like Alexander, and it's still, to me, Gladiator sets the tone and the bar for these kind of movies. At this point, these kind of revival of the sword and sandal epics. And I don't mean the fantasy things. I'm not talking about things with dragons, but things with, you know, mystical gods and mm-hmm. and battling armies. But even at this point, this was kind of getting old hat, because we had had 3 Lord of the Rings movies, which had the computerized battles, you know, with the 1,000-person army. And so that, you know, that special effect wasn't all that special anymore. And I think there might have been a little bit of audience weariness of seeing these epic battle movies at the time. Do you recall that, or did you feel that at all?
I mean, that's what Ebert said. I think that's a total line of bullshit. You know, clearly he just doesn't like these types of movies, period. I just look at his track record. So I disagree. And it clearly isn't something that's apparent in the box office for these types of movies either. When you look at a movie like Alexander versus Gladiator or Troy, it's clear why it failed. Right, I don't think anyone's thinking, "Oh God, it was the fighting." They didn't like the fighting anymore. They thought it was no good. Really, I mean, that's not an argument that makes sense to me.
You know, I will say this in support of what Ebert said, and we'll get into like that review. Let you guys hear that later on in the show. But in agreement of something he said, I remember at the time feeling a little bit nonchalant about some of the things that I was seeing on screen. And then during this director's cut, I thought, "Oh, this is much better." And we talked too on our last podcast. Mm-hmm. It wasn't retro, but on our last podcast in general about The Karate Kid. And I want to bring it up because it has relevance here with this movie too. Even though this movie is 2004, only 13 years ago as we speak now, special effects still hold up fine. But there's a visual simplicity, once again, to this that makes it extremely easy to watch and follow and respect and get an idea of what the hell is going on that is sorely lacking in the movies today. I didn't get overwhelmed visually and tune out, mm-hmm. and which is a problem, I think, with a lot of movies today.
The other thing I would argue about this is, looking back on this, Ebert talks about armies that are too many people, right? There's too many people that come out and fight that wouldn't fit in the city. I disagree. I almost thought there were not enough people in these battles. You know what I mean? I thought this barely fills the frame at some points, but just enough. And to me, this felt very believable. Whereas nowadays, you damn well know if they did this, it would really be over the top. So I don't know if that's just a point in time where every movie needs to be bigger than the one before, right? Because I actually would think Gladiator had far more people in it than Troy.
But Troy, you can still feel the sweat. You can still feel the hard production. This is the film debut.
But you agree. You have to agree with both. And I guess the same with Gladiator. But with this movie, the war scenes are the lesser of what is actually on the screen here. Those aren't really the big moments for this movie.
I think there's 3 great scenes in this movie, okay. in my opinion. One is on the boat where Paris tells Hector he's done something wrong. I love that scene.
Good scene.
I think the second scene that is a great scene is when Hector and Achilles finally fight each other, which is the only battle mm-hmm. scene I'll include in this. And I think the last great scene in this movie is when Peter O'Toole asks to take the body back from Brad Pitt. I think mm-hmm. those three scenes encapsulate. I mean, there's good scenes, obviously, sprinkled throughout it. But I think those three scenes hold this kind of, everything's mounted around those in a lot of ways. And the pivotal mm-hmm. scenes and the contribution of Eric Bana to this movie cannot be overlooked.
Eric Bana is awesome in this movie. And I thought so at the time. And I still think so. And in watching this, it's just like, damn, why is this guy not, you know, in more stuff? I mean, did the Incredible Hulk really do that much damage to his career? Was he just never able to do anything really after this that raised anyone's awareness of him? But he really is. He should have been in more heroic things, because he really is just one of those guys that you just kind of root for. Like, he's just a good guy.
My personal theory is that Gerard Butler came along and stole his career.
Yeah, he stole the dumpster that he was going to move into.
No, Bana was in Deliverance from Evil recently, which I thought was okay. And he's popped up in a couple of things. So he's still
He's around, but I mean, that's...
Didn't have the career we thought he was going to have, especially based on his charisma in this movie. He is fantastic. And I love the scenes with him and his wife, Safan Burrows, in this, mm-hmm. who's making one of her, kind of big budget debuts in this. Rose Byrne, I forgot she was even in mm-hmm. this movie. Diane Kruger as Helen. Diane Kruger had something interesting to say about the making of this. If you go on IMDb, it's on there. I mean, she talks very ill of Peter O'Toole, who was a diva during the making of this movie and was drunk all the time, and it was not pleasant to be around, she states. So there was some history. Obviously, Brad Pitt, if you didn't know, snapped his Achilles tendon hopping out of the boat in that shot that where he jumps off the front there of the boat and lands in the sand. So cracked his Achilles while playing Achilles, which has always been an interesting thing, and a hell of a production that went overboard, over budget, and 100 degree heat shooting days like that. So that struggle and all of that is in this film, and I think that's what makes it somewhat of a richer picture. And I love these toga movies, and I call them toga movies, but these kind of mm-hmm. warm night movies, if you will, like these Gladiator, these Troy, I mean, even Alexander's
Sandal epics.
Yeah, but they're not fantasy-esque where, you know, you got wizards and shit. You do have gods and you have superstitions, and I think it's a smart move mm-hmm. to leave
there's
the
no
gods
real
out
gods
of
in this one. I know, me too. I think that Benioff's script here does a really good job of modernizing this and making it feel more like a real, true-to-life history, even though it's pulled from different areas of different stories.
Yeah,
especially
a lot
the director's cut.
A number of people, including Ebert, had a problem with the fact that they differentiated from the Iliad, which this is obviously based on. But the fact is that this got people interested in going back and reading that. I recall mm-hmm. the summer this came out, I saw guys and girls on the beach reading the Iliad, which had the new cover with the Brad Pitt poster on the cover of the book, but still people were going back and at least mm-hmm. reading the source.
Now
material,
a hit so. Motion picture?
Yeah, exactly. You know how they do that, right? in current relief.
Yeah. So I thought Matt Damon was always in the books.
It's great that it even got people to go back and look at that. So that's a big plus in my opinion. But let's take a quick break and let you guys listen to the trailer for Troy. We'll be back with you and our thoughts of the story.
Come with me. I will love you.
Don't play with me. Don't play.
I want her back. Will you go to war with me, brother?
We're sending the largest fleet that ever sailed.
We need Achilles. He can't be controlled.
We don't need to control him, we need to unleash him. That man was born to end lives.
You'd let Troy burn for this woman?
I won't let you start a war for her.
I've killed men, and I've heard them dying, and I've watched them dying, and there's nothing glorious about it, nothing poetic.
You say you want to die for love, but you know nothing about dying, and you know nothing about love.
And Hector's, he's good a warrior, as they say.
The best of all the Trojans.
I won't ask you to fight my war. You already have.
This movie begins very differently in the director's cut than it does in the theatrical version. You said you don't recall the theatrical version. It starts right with the armies marching up. There's none of that introspective Sean Bean narration, the dog stuff, any of that. Do you like the leisurely pace of this director's cut overall? You didn't find it padded?
Not at all. I was really into it, the whole thing. And I really dove into the whole soap opera side of this as well, and really loved the struggle of what it's, you know, what it means to be a great warrior, and does that make you a great man, or do you have to make a choice, you know? And that to me was kind of the theme, the thematic thing that ran through this whole movie, both with Paris and Hector and Achilles, and even Agamemnon to some degree as well.
Well, it's a film about, it's a story in a film with Benioff's, you know, we're not talking, let's get this clear, we're not talking about the Iliad, you know, that's a whole different topic here. We're talking about Troy as it's presented on screen here in the story, right, by Benioff and what he's chose to focus on. And the film in its story here is a lot about brothers, you know, Paris and Hector, obviously, and Agamemnon and Melanias. But who here is in the wrong in this story? Is Paris really the villain in this?
No, well, that's what I'm saying. I think that the movie's really about what does it take to be a good man, and is being a warrior, is that something that makes you good, right? I mean, Paris stands up for what he believes is right, right? And he saves Helen, and he basically has to, and he challenges the king, right?
Brendan Gleeson's character.
Later on, right? and winds up turning out to be quite a little weenie about
coward.
It, right? And you would say coward and whatnot, but is he a better man than the Spartan king? Still probably so. I mean, this is something that Hector deals with as well, right? He is not as good as Achilles. Is he a better man, even though Achilles kicks the shit out of him?
He's more honorable.
But that's, again, one of the key things, right? Hector doesn't give a shit about honor. Right, that's what Achilles is out there. I mean, Hector fights for his country, right? He's not out there to fight just to fight to make a name for himself or anything like that. So he's definitely not worried about the same things that Achilles is worried about, and the reason that Achilles is here. And of course, with the Rose Byrne character, he winds up flip-flopping, making the other choice, deciding to be a better man than worrying about being a better warrior or making a name for himself. And it winds up getting him killed. Actually, it winds up getting most everyone killed except for Paris.
And Paris is the only character out of all these that will make it out alive, you know, out of the three main male characters here. And for Orlando Bloom, apparently he didn't like the character, found him to be too much of a coward and not aggressive enough to his liking. But I think that it's great casting here all around, with Banna and Bloom looking somewhat similar as brothers, and you feel that he almost has a protective nature over the slighter Bloom, and that his delicateness wouldn't be in the same home as these grizzled killers. I love Brian Cox and Brendan Gleeson as the two confronting kings that are the invading Greek kings. And there is a lot of good stuff. Although Sean Bean, who is Odysseus, it kind of just shoehorned in, right?
I know. Especially since he's the guy that makes the pivotal horse, and it really is kind of like such an important character. And yeah, you're right. They do just kind of stick him in there. At least he doesn't die, so he should be happy about that.
It is like a nod, obviously, to the Odyssey and things going on with the return trip home.
Right.
And all that kind of stuff. But I will say this. This director's cut gets weighed down to me a little bit once Hector dies. In theatrical cut, we speed up to the end, and for better or worse, there are some nice moments here that I don't recall previously that take their time a little bit, particularly the lead up to Hector going out and fighting Achilles is handled much better in this director's cut. He's given a lot more time to kind of get his affairs in order. It's almost like he's knows that he's heading out to certain doom, where it didn't feel like that so much in the theatrical cut. I appreciated that here. What do you think about the scene with Peter O'Toole asking for his son's body back and to not let it be desecrated? Is it just me, or is that one of the best scenes in the movie?
Yeah, I mean, the minute he walks in and kisses the Achilles' hands, you're just like, oh my God, is there anything more Greek than this scene right here? Like, as far as like Greek literature goes, like it just reminds you of, if you ever read anything like this in high school, it just brings you right back to the, you know, it's just like, oh wow, yes, this is exactly how it would be. I love that a scene like this is kind of helps Achilles, you know, it kind of turns him a little bit, gives him an idea of who he's actually fighting and who he's fighting for, which he's always throughout the movie had a big problem with. And it kind of sets him on a better path, right?
Well, this is also a story about chances not taking and things that could have been diverted. You know, if the slave girl slits Achilles' throat, then there's no, you know, there's nothing that yeah. no one else dies. If Hector doesn't kill Patroclus, then they're going on the ship in the morning and yes. there's no rest of the horses.
I mean, this is definitely
it's very tragic.
That's what I was just going to say. It's definitely this script keeps all the Greek tragedy stuff in it, you know, and, you know, very Shakespearean, even though that's much later, but still right. very much of the same ideas, you know.
It's a Greek tragedy.
Right.
I think the weakest scene in this movie, or the most unfair scene, is the fight between Achilles and Hector that turns out to be the cheat, because it's Pitt in this, in every shot, and then it turns out, oh, it's Garrett Hedlund, the cousin, when he takes off the helmet. That's a bullshit
yeah.
scene.
Yeah. I know, because it doesn't. You can clearly tell, like just body wise. I don't know. It really isn't. It's not the cousin, right?
No, it's Pitt in every shot.
It has to be, because body wise, it looks too big. He looks too thick.
That's what she said. I had to. I just. Well, no. We just lost every last listener 37 minutes in. It's a bad scene in a good movie up until that point, and I like how this thing is structured. Like you said, over the course of 3 hours that zip by, in my opinion, mm-hmm. the first hour ends with the Greeks winning, the second hour wins with the Trojans fighting them back and winning, and the third hour you have Troy burning because of the Trojan horse, which is actually a silly bit of Greek mythology, but is handled with care in. I don't say seriousness here, but a level of realism that makes it palatable. That's the only way to describe it. How else would you carry this off? You know, the best it could be done.
Well, just like everything else they've done in this movie, those aren't the important parts. Right? The important part isn't that they built the Trojan horse and got inside the gates and stuff. It's what happens after, right? It's the horrible things.
Yeah, the sacking
at least in this
of the
director's
city.
Cut, anyways, the sacking of the city, right? And then the ultimate demise of all the characters, in classic kind of soap opera fashion. What happens to them during this whole battle as it's going down? So I don't know. To me, that was and really most of the battles and stuff in that way. You know, when he kills. The cousin or whatever, the nephew or whoever the hell it is, cousin, I guess.
Yeah.
Hector says to Sean Bean, you know, this is enough killing for one day. It's like, well, we've had the big moment here that we need to have. Fuck the war.
You know? I'm good. Are you good? Okay, I'm good too.
Yeah. See you tomorrow. And that happens a lot in this movie, because it's just not like the battle scenes are there and stuff, but a lot of times I even feel, even in this a director's cut, they're kind of abbreviated to get to the point of the soap opera, right? Of what's going on with these main characters.
I like these kind of soap operas. It's hands down. This is, and I don't watch Game of Thrones, and that's a crazy thing to reveal on our podcast. But
well, that's great, and it's just like this. Except
I know
it's even more drawn out for an hour.
I should get into it.
It feels
I'll
like 3 hours
in 10 years from now, and I'll bring it up to you, and you can tell me to shut the fuck up. Like I do. It's like, have you seen Lost?
Yeah,
I will get into it at some point because I do like the soap opera aspect of this. It doesn't feel out of place for some reason when they're acting Shakespearean or Greek.
You love
or
it. I love it. I mean, I really like the Hector character and Paris, like the whole, as you mentioned before, the brothers stuff. And then when you can skip over to Achilles' storyline and then skip back to that. And then there, and in a lot of the scenes, it almost feels like, I can't remember exactly what was said, but you know, Hector said something to Paris, and then they cut to Achilles, and it's almost as if Hector said that shit to Achilles.
It, well, yeah, their fates are lining up from the beginning, and they
right.
clearly make it that Achilles has been touched by some sort of godly power, with the mom being a mystic, and the fact that
right,
he
has
a
little
spear,
he has a little jump move. That's what he does. He jumps to the side. Strike with the sword, and that's his move. He does it a couple times in the movie, and you're like, what the hell?
To open that movie. Is it not? That's a great way to open that thing
up. I guess if he would just stop doing it throughout the rest of the movie. That's like his move. If it was a video game, that would be like his forward B, you know? That's his move.
It's a nicely mounted production here, production design-wise. I like all the armor and the look of the film.
Mm-hmm.
I like the scene when the boats are there and the guy throws Ajax throws the other guy up and has them you know, Greeks are dying on the beach, you lazy boy. I mean, I like this kind of intensity yeah. that the movie contains at times, and it's compulsively watchable. Even over, you know, mm-hmm. this version we're talking about is 33 minutes longer than the already 160 mm-hmm. minute length theatrical cut. So it takes some dedication to get through this, but it's not hard to watch if you're into the characters.
Super
and
easy
on.
To watch. Yeah, it just floats by. You can watch this in the afternoon. Yeah.
I remember thinking that Pitt's performance in this was not embarrassing, but was very, I don't know.
It really
on the
is.
Nose.
I would still say still is. He doesn't appear to be doing any hard work here at all.
Yeah, kind of getting a suntan.
Yeah.
Kind of how I felt like, you know.
But it almost plays into the character because the character is supposed to be very arrogant.
And lazy.
And so, I don't know, maybe he is putting a lot into it and he's just so good I'm not realizing it. Yeah.
Method, asshole.
What do you think about the music? You want to talk about the music a little bit?
Yes. Let's talk. Do you know what the history about the score?
Beautiful. Yeah.
Tell our listeners about the score.
Well, Gabriel Yared originally did the score. And I've never heard. Have you heard his? Is that available anywhere?
It was for a long time on torrents. Hmm. I think back in the day I had it, some sort of a torrent version
was
of it.
Was it better? Well, James Horner they brought in to redo it because I guess they didn't people didn't like it, you know. And this, interestingly, isn't the first time or isn't the last time Gabriel Yared's score has been rejected and redone. He also did The Tourist, which James Newton Howard, I believe, did it. So James H's are enemies of Gabriel Yared. That's for sure.
I wonder how bland your score has to be replaced.
That's
twice.
Why I always wondered. I wanted to hear this, and I never heard his original Tourist one either. I don't know if either of those are available. But he's done mostly European movies, you know. But he has done some other stuff. Let's see what But he's done movies like City of Angels. I don't really remember that. The English Patient. That's pretty big. Message in a Bottle, The Talented Mr. Ripley, Autumn in New York, The Next Best Thing, Possession, Cold Mountain, Shall yeah. We Dance? I mean.
Well, then it's not action films, I'll tell you that. So
1408, there you go.
It makes sense that he'd be replaced then because this is a beautiful score, I think. This is a
yeah, this is an awesome, awesome score. I will say that there is a little bit of Planet of the Apes in this
is
movie.
Is there?
Yes, 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 yes. Hector and Achilles when they fight. That is Danny Elfman's Planet of the Apes.
Interesting. I did not know that. I have to look that up. I think you have a copyright infringement lawsuit on your hands there.
Well, they're both Warner Brothers, so.
And I think Horner, unfortunately, has passed on, so good luck getting any money out of the estate there.
No. However, well, this was just in the director's cut. It really is literally just filled in.
Oh, I just heard some other James Horner score today from, what was it, the Magnificent Seven? One of those popped on Spotify, and I thought, man, this is strikingly similar to his work on The Mask of Zorro, which happens a lot in composers' careers.
Yeah, for sure.
Start mimicking themselves quite often. You Hans Zimmer's stuff, I mean, some of that's almost indistinguishable from one another.
Oh,
so,
hell yeah.
But Horner has constructed...
But this is one of the better...
This is a great score.
Scores.
It's got that grandeur and splendor of the era mm-hmm. and of the look and the intensity of it. It's captured very, very well in this score. We'll play a little bit longer of this as we go out.
The only other thing around in this that I would say it's clearly, obviously better would be Braveheart, which is just tits of a score.
Well, that's an Oscar-winning score.
That's what I'm saying. That's the only thing that I could compare really to this that was just, I mean, obviously the Gladiator score as well was better than this. This is a really great movie, but it's just not as great as the greatest movies in this category, yeah. Right? That's kind of what I'm trying to say. You know, I'm not trying to cut it down. I'm just saying, you know, it's surprisingly better than you think it would be.
Well, it's almost like saying Casino's not that great when you compare it to Godfather and Goodfellas, but it's still, you know,
right,
it's a great
exactly.
Movie,
you know? Yeah, like, well, you just got to get the perspective right on it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we compare to the two best the genre ever produced, it's not that great, but you know, normally.
I'm just saying, well, I'm not going to be humming any Troy music after I watch this movie. I don't actually really remember it, but I do remember it was really good and really fit the movie and everything. Whereas, like, Braveheart, I remember the melodies and stuff.
Watching this movie, sometimes I thought, like, this is reminds me of Star Wars or The Phantom Menace or something. You know what I mean? When you could realize, oh, Lucas was really doing the old knights and Greek stuff in his episodes.
You know? I never even thought about that. Yeah.
I got a lot of vibes of Phantom Menace.
No, you're right. Now that you say that, yeah.
Let's listen to Ebert and Ropert do their spin on this movie. We got to let you know, this was from their worst of 2004 list. And going into this, this will be topping Ebert's list. So there's a little background on this clip.
My choice as the year's worst film is a tie. Yes,
cheater.
A tie vote, ladies cheater. And gentlemen. A tie between Troy and Alexander. How can you choose?
I can choose.
Okay, there's two stories here of unconvincing heroes leading unlikely armies into incomprehensible battles between inconsequential love scenes and dialogue so unlikely it could have been written directly for Mad Magazine. And Troy, Brad Pitt played Achilles, who was but one man in an army of countless thousands or millions or trillions, I don't know, but everything stopped for his big fight. And Alexander was played by another actor who ought to fire his agent, Colin Farrell.
Conquer your fear! And I promise you, you will conquer death!
Everybody talked about the sex in Alexander, but only Rosario Dawson did anything about it, and for that, I am grateful to Rosario Dawson. I never understood why Gladiator won the Oscar, but it was a masterpiece compared to Troy and Alexander. Maybe the secret, how about this, is to make a good movie about strong characters and abandon the idea of showing vast armies conquering the world. Every time Alexander gave a speech to his troops, I wondered how the guys in the back were able to hear.
I kind of like these movies. I think, first of all, Alexander is just...
Enough to recommend them?
Yeah, I mean, Alexander, as I said when we did it on the show, it's pure campy entertainment. There's so much going on there. It's an absolute mess, but I found it to be a hoot. And I think Troy's a better film than that.
Alexander was too slow and too long to be...
Well, you know what? When it comes out on video, people can go from scene to scene. You can check out Jared Leto's nice mascara. You can check out Rosario Dawson doing that kind of... That sex scene like this, and Angelina Jolie and her snakes. Okay. I mean, there's good stuff there.
Troy was probably the better movie, especially Peter O'Toole's scene. But, I mean, the armies were so big that all those people wouldn't fit inside the city they came out of. I mean, it was ridiculous as far as special effects were concerned.
I want to also give you credit for coming up with the concept of the tie, because you got to put 11 movies now on your list
instead of 10.
Yes. So next year I may have a...
All right. Clearly they didn't like this movie. We liked it more than them.
Well, Roper liked it.
Roper liked it more than Alexander, and he liked it more than Ebert did, but I still...
He gives a positive review if you... Go back, or if you read his review, he gives a positive review. Ebert gives a negative, very negative one.
He claims it's fun. I don't think it's necessarily a fun movie, but it's a good movie. Fun? Would you say this is a fun movie?
I thought this was relatively fun. I mean, it depends on what you categorize as fun. I was entertained the entire time. I was really into the story. I was having fun. There's not a lot... there is tragedy in this, but it really doesn't overtake the overall story. The whole movie doesn't bring you down.
Do you think he's stuck on the fact that this was such a departure from the source material?
But I don't know why. It doesn't make any sense to me. Well, this is the best
interpretation you could make of this material. I have seen numerous miniseries.
It's a movie
of this, and they're never as good as this movie. I mean, I've seen various ones done over the years, and BBC did one. There was one straight to video that they did at one point.
Well, it doesn't say based on a true story. You know, it doesn't say. If anything, actually, it says inspired by. To be totally fair to this movie. So I don't know. I really thought this worked really well for what it was. I would rather watch this than have them try to cram in everything else.
Compared to Alexander, which one do you pick?
I pick this.
Yeah, I do too. Though I think Alexander is an interesting folly.
Kingdom of Heaven.
Kingdom of Heaven is almost unwatchable. Have you seen that recently?
No, I barely got through it the first time, man. Oh, my God. Like, literally all I can remember is just him riding the fucking horse, like, into the village and shit. And it just took him forever to fucking get there.
Yeah, it was like the Manchester of the Sea by...
Like, what the hell's going on? Yeah, why is this movie so long?
Shot in real time. but getting back to Troy here, like you said, this movie would go on to do very, very well here and abroad. And cement Pitt as a major star. This was particularly in the era of the falling era of Tom Cruise, too. This was in that whole Pitt-Cruise I don't say rivalry, but there was a question of who was the bigger star between the two, and they both were coming out with hit after hit. And this was a big, big summer blockbuster that did very, very well. And like I said, it continues to play. And I understand because you can catch snippets of this, and it's even broken up on TBS or whatever.
I don't know that it did that well.
I mean, $185 million? I can't imagine.
Well, it made $133 million.
Yeah, but today's money. Today's money opens up with $65 million. I can't think of another star-driven sword and sorcery or sword and sandal epic that would do this with a star today. Can you? I mean,
well, are you going to compare it to just that? I mean, that's obviously very limited. Even back then, that's limited.
Yeah, but what star is going to open up a Greek mythology action film today?
I don't know. I mean, again, that's what I'm saying, though. That's limited. That's even limited back then. How many of them were made and failed? A lot of these sword and sandal movies don't typically do well for a long time.
Well, they haven't done well in a long time. Now,
that's what I mean.
Ben-Hur failing most recently, which I kind of wanted to see after I watched this for some reason. I don't know why. I was like,
just get a taste.
You know, yeah. One's done badly over there.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, did this do well? They said like it made like $500 million worldwide. I mean, most of its money was made overseas, so that gives you an idea that it didn't really do a huge amount here as compared to other movies, but worldwide, sure, I guess.
It was, to be fair, outgrossed by Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which came out the following year here domestically, which was an even bigger hit for Pitt. But then things started to go very wrong for him at the box office after that. He started focusing on Ocean's movies and the smaller independent stuff. He's had a career much like Cruise, where he has tried to work in the smaller films amongst these tentpole type stuff. You know, he did did the big movies and then tried to do something like Devil's Own and 7 Years in Tibet, and he's really off. And Babel, obviously, it was the one that comes after this. But those Ocean's movies, talk about sleepwalking through movies. I feel like this Ocean's 11, I mean, he just picked up some paychecks in 2004. He left all the energy in the gym.
Well, you know, as much as he should have, I guess. I don't know.
And Wolfgang Peterson, what happened to him? He just turned into Roland Emmerich at the end of his career there. I mean, Poseidon, was that his last film that was ever released? I can't recall him doing a film after that. And he had done solid work up to that point.
Yes.
I mean, blockbusters that were entertaining and had some intelligence to them. In the Line of Fire comes to mind.
I was just
going to
say, I've always been a fan of Enemy Mine.
Enemy Mine. The Perfect Storm is very watchable for what it is.
I don't know. That's kind of...
Yeah, it's pushing it.
That one's starting to get there. Outbreak basically sucks.
But Poseidon, man.
And Poseidon, which I never think I really even got all the way through.
And it's only 98 minutes. Every time I watch a movie, I go, it's so long. And it's over. And he goes, 98 minutes? It feels longer than Troy, which is 3 hours and 6 minutes. poor Wolfgang Peters, because he is not Roland Emmerich. And this guy can tell a story visually and handle actors and block a scene well, which is evident here. So, good movie. I'm glad I went back and watched it. I'm glad we got this on the Voodoo. So I'm going to throw this in the most streaming, clear
version. Yeah, right. We got a good version of it, so that's nice.
So if you do get a chance to watch this, try to find it. You know, I bought this on DVD. I have this director's cut on 2-disc DVD.
Right, yeah.
2-disc, not even a Blu-ray, but DVD. I think it's the last brand new store-bought DVD I ever bought. And the Best Buy sticker is still on it, and it's $16.99.
Yeah. And that's probably a price that's good today for those types of things.
My goodness.
If they in fact do make 2-disc DVDs anymore, I don't think they make shit. They make like a 1-disc thing, sell you for like $30, right?
Yeah,
and I think literally that's what they do now.
I couldn't believe that. I looked at this and thought, my God, I paid almost $20 for this movie, and it's over 2 discs. I can't remember where they broke it at, but this.
Oh no! It just has the movie's all on 1 disc. It just has an extra disc. I thought.
No, it's broken up over 2 discs. It has the special features because there are special features on this.
It's broken up over two discs.
Yes, this movie, it says continue on disc two. I remember that for sure.
Seems unnecessary.
It's like the flipper discs of the early DVD days. If you own like a Time to Kill, you know you have to flip that disc.
Well, this was around the time, that would have been like 2007, which was about around the time when Warner Brothers was fucking around with two disc sets and things and trying to get people to pay more. Seeing what people, the price points people were willing to pay for a single disc with no special features and like two disc sets with like massive special features and things. So, sounds like you got caught up in that.
Yeah, they got me.
I just remember. I do know that this is, if you get this, actually, I don't think this would have come out too late, but you can get the original cut of this on VHS. I think it's only one tape.
Oh, well, there they are.
So,
there's something to be on the lookout for.
Yeah, there's that. Well, I had the two tape set of Braveheart. That was a real treat.
I had the two tape set of Titanic.
Yes. Oh, I never had that. I never had Titanic.
Don't lie. We watched it together. Yeah. Maybe in the future we'll do a retro on that.
I just want to know who winds up in the water and who winds up on
which one of us is on the piece of floating wood. We'll let you decide that.
Because I'm telling you, if you know what, no matter what it comes down to, like if I have to hold you up at the bow of the ship or whatever, I'll be on the
you're
door.
Floater?
You can be. You can be in the water.
I think there's room for both of us up on this piece of wood.
We'll have to find an old car somewhere.
I think our next retro, though, to give you guys a little bit of sneak peek here, will be American Pie. American Pie 2.
Yeah, I'd say American Pie 2. Let's do it.
Yeah, we think it was one of the best teen raunch comedies ever. So we'll be back with you guys soon with the retro for American Pie 2. As for this retro episode of Troy the Director's Cut, we want to thank you guys for joining us on this special retro edition and for your continued support. Remember, check us out on Facebook, go to moviemavericks.com, like us, review the show on iTunes. Once again, speaking for Trevor Anderson, I'm Jason Rugard, and we are the Movie Mavericks.